Carrie tried to set Fred up to take a fatal fall. Now Fred is coming for payback. And Frankie, Sammy, and Dean have a message for Fred, a message from a very pissed off Stedmar Osborne. Welcome to the serialized audiobook, The Detective, written by Scott Sigler and Matt Wallace, narrated by Scott Sigler. Hello, junkies! Welcome to The Detective episode number 7. After this, only 3 episodes left. Count them, 1, 2, 3. The feces gonna flap against the flinger for sure. This episode features some of my favorite minor characters in the GFL universe, Frankie, Sammy, and Dean. They are not the Rat Pack, but if the Rat Pack were huge mafia goons, these guys would be them. I have another story out there with the characters named Ronnie and Bobby and Ricky and Mike, so you can see the influence of music on my work. Just go cool it down and come back and listen to more. I'm still banging away on 3 major deadlines for Aliens Phalanx, GFL Book 6, and Mount Fitzroy, the sequel to Earthcore. So I'm just going to drop this episode right here, and I'm going to go back to work writing stuff for you. Here we go with The Detective, episode number 7. Book 5. McCovey. Chapter 19. Stedmar. This time, Fred opted for more expensive digs. He'd done the low-rent hotels in McCovey and stayed out of sight, but to use another low-rent facility would be to create a pattern. In his line of work, patterns were bad. So, just for the sake of the job, mind you, he picked a 4-star place to clean up and gather his thoughts before he went after Carney. 4-star facilities meant nanite showers. Most McCoveyans wanted cleaning facilities that used real water. Just another indicator of how primitive this culture could be. Fred stood in the nanite stall, raising his arms, turning his body this way and that, to let the tiny machines work every area of his skin and scalp. He even opened his mouth, letting them swarm on his tongue, his teeth, his gums, and the inside of his cheeks. In an hour, maybe less, he'd go to the mines and see if Carney was still there. Hopefully, the man would be. Tracking someone down in McCovey wasn't impossible, but it wasn't much fun, and Fred wanted to be done with his business before any message from Bobby Brobst could arrive via punch drive relays. But what was Carney's game? Why had such a nice kid sent Fred to his possible death? Odds were Carney had no idea of what was going on. Greedock must have gotten to him. If not Greedock, then Stedmar Osborne, crime lord of McCovey, and Greedock's underling. Maybe they put pressure on Carney to betray Fred. Maybe they'd offered the kid a ton of money to deliver the note and the story. Fred couldn't blame Carn if that was the case. Greedock's pocket change was likely more than Carney could make in a decade. The nanite bin let out a beep. Fred was as scrubbed could be. The fog of tiny machines filtered back into the bin, leaving Fred naked and spotless. He stepped out of the stall and into the bathroom. What disguise would he use this time? An old man? Maybe a woman? He'd give that some thought, but first he needed to eat. Once he went after Carney, there was no telling if he'd have time to stop for a bite. Fred opened the bathroom door, then stared, stunned. "Hey, Mr. Gonzaga, how you doing?" The 2 human men standing outside the bathroom filled Fred with the urge to slam the door, dive for cover, and grab the nearest weapon. He didn't do any of those things, of course. That was just his fight-or-flight instinct being triggered. The men were huge. They wore tailored suits that probably had weapons hidden inside the jackets. He was naked. If they'd wanted him dead, they would have come in and killed him. They wanted to talk. If he attacked them, that could change quite quickly. His false identity hadn't drawn any suspicion at the McCovey shuttleport. He hadn't used that identity before, at least not in McCovey. How had they found him? And who were they? What worried him most of all, though, was their demeanor. These guys were gangland thugs. they knew how to fight. Two-on-one, unarmed, Fred didn't stand a chance. "Hi," Fred said. "If you guys are waiting to take a dump, I'm all done in there." The one on the right smiled. He had white-pink skin, black hair, and a neck that was as thick as Fred's waist. The one on the left didn't smile. He had black skin, deep black, with tight, curly black hair that looked coated with oil. His right eye was a sheen of wet steel.
"My name is Frankie," said the man on the right.
He nodded at the other one.
"This is Sammy."
The names made Fred realize just how much trouble he was in.
"Frankie and Sammy," Fred said.
"Where's Dean?"
"Busy," Frankie said. "Very busy. Mr. Osborne would like a word with you."
Frankie, Sammy, and Dean, the three primary bodyguards slash hitters slash knuckle breakers of one Stedmar Osborne. No-neck Frankie was obviously the talker of the two. Sammy's one good eye looked out with the blank stare of a sociopath.
"You should get dressed," Frankie said.
"You guys gonna watch? Usually people like to see me take it all off, not put it all on."
Frankie smiled.
"I've heard that you always got something funny to say, and here I am, so well known for my ability to listen to other people's jokes."
Somehow, Fred doubted that. Sammy crossed his huge arms over his chest.
"If you don't want to get dressed, I can bring you in just like that."
Fred held up a hand.
"No, that's okay. I'll just throw on a little something."
Frankie gestured to the bedroom where Fred's clothes were.
"Quicker is better than slower."
Fred walked into the bedroom and started to get dressed. Both men stood in the doorway, watching. That didn't mean they were perverts. It meant they were professionals. If they'd left Fred alone, he could have found a way out or found a stashed weapon. If just one watched him, there was a chance Fred could try his luck, hoping to take that one out and even the odds. But both of them together, it kept things calm and predictable. Fred held up a black t-shirt.
"Should I wear black? If I'm not coming back from this meeting, I might as well look the part."
Frankie shrugged.
"That's not up to me. But you seem like you've been around, Mr. Gonzaga. If Mr. Osborne wanted you in the ground, you'd already be there."
Sammy nodded. Fred dressed.
How had they found him? Had Greedock somehow got word to his lieutenant? If Bobby had gotten out quick, his message would still be routing through the various punch space relays.
Whatever the reason, whatever the plan, Frankie and Sammy had him now. All Fred could do was play it out. Osborne's office was almost tasteful, but the man obviously enjoyed opulence. Fred spotted items that must have been imported from over a dozen systems at great cost. The limo ride over had been uneventful. Fred found himself wanting to question Frankie about his background, but he didn't. Mostly because Sammy sat beside him the whole way, never taking his eye off Fred. He couldn't decide the cycloptic killer was merely being vigilant or if he was actively hoping for an excuse to break Fred's neck. When they led Fred through ornate double doors, he found Stedmar sitting behind a slab of a desk. Another gigantic man in a suit stood behind him. Dean, most likely. Osborne had the poker face of a consummate businessman. Fred imagined he was a hell of a negotiator.
"He cause any trouble?"
Osborne said to Frankie.
"No, Mr. Osborne," Frankie said. "He seems like a smart one."
"Good," Stedmar said. "Smart, I like. Saves time."
Frankie ushered Fred into one of the guest chairs on the opposite side of Osborne's desk. Fred settled in. He found his fear had subsided, replaced by a deep curiosity about where all of this was going. Meanwhile, Frankie and Sammy took up positions behind him, flanking him closely. Osborne leaned forward, elbows on his desk.
"You want a drink?"
"A drink? Well, this was downright hospitable."
"Scotch. Neat."
"Dean, get the man a scotch," Osborne said. "No ice. And get me a limoncello, will you?"
Dean nodded and walked over to the bar, where he set about using his thick, scarred hands to fix the drinks. Frankie and Sammy remained stationed behind Fred.
"You haven't asked who I am, so I assume you know," Osborne said.
Fred nodded.
He took in the infinity symbol tattooed on Osborne's forehead. That meant the man was a confirmed member of the Purist Church, yet he wore a suit instead of blue robes. Although Fred was sure the man was more interested in how that status could aid his criminal enterprise, the symbol still filled Fred with a blind and familiar rage. Dean brought the drinks. Fred resisted the urge to down his in one gulp. Instead, he sipped, casually. Stedmar sipped his own drink and studied Fred.
"You know, I can't tell if you're scared out of your mind or if you're as diamond hard as I've heard."
Fred offered him nothing. Osborne looked above Fred's right shoulder.
"What do you think, Frankie?"
"Hard doesn't mean as much as most people think,"
said Frankie from behind Fred's back.
"We could find out," said Sammy. "I volunteer."
Osborne nodded, as if to say that could still be on the agenda. He set his drink down.
"Not just yet," he said.
He folded his hands atop his desk. His eyes bore into Fred.
"You broke into my stadium," he said. "You stole from me. That much I know. We've also got a dead city worker and two charred Quith warriors out in the dunes. Now, a dead citizen is bad enough, but two alien corpses on Makovey, on Purist Nation soil, where no member of the satanic races are ever supposed to set foot? Do you have a single shucking clue how much heat I'm going to take from the holy men? And the bats, they're doing flybys outside my damn window every hour on the hour."
Fred did his best to stay still, to not show any emotion. Stedmar had tracked him down because of the stadium? Maybe he didn't know about Bobby Probst. If he didn't, how long until he did? How long until a message from Greedock arrived on Makovey? A message that said, "Kill Frederico Esteban Gasipi Gonzaga the moment you see him." What that really meant, though, was that Fred had a chance. If he could finish up here and get back on the streets before any such message arrived, he could live. Stedmar was obviously no dummy. When dealing with a smart man, don't try to talk him out of what he already knows.
"That's all true," Fred said. "I admit it."
To his surprise, Osborne laughed.
"I think you're right, Frankie. He is hard."
Osborne handed Dean his empty glass, and the hulking, dim-looking thug took it back to the bar for a refill.
"You know, Fred, may I call you Fred?"
Osborne didn't wait for a response before speaking on.
"Fred, the only reason I haven't had my boys ventilate your skull is because Frankie there seems to think you haven't really done anything to hurt or insult me. Nothing that you can't buy your way out of, I mean, and that you might have information that's of use to me. Those Quith you torched in the old shipyard? Not mine. That means someone else is working my territory, and I want to know who it is. If you can tell me that, maybe it's worth your life. Maybe. Tell me what you're doing in my mining colony, Fred."
Fred's expression didn't change, didn't even waver, but Stedmar's words changed the game. The man was part of Greedock's syndicate. He was a high-ranking player, as far as Fred knew. If Greedock wanted to get at Fred while he was on Makovey, Osborne was the logical choice to tap for that job. But he hadn't tapped Stedmar. Why? Why send non-human hitters to Makovey instead of using Frankie and Sammy and Dean? There was only one conclusion to draw. Greedock didn't want his human lieutenant to know about the operation or its nature. He didn't want Osborne to gain access to the information on Quentin Barnes that was at the heart of this thing. Whether that was because Greedock simply didn't trust Osborne, or whether it had to do with Barnes specifically, Fred couldn't know. But it might be the only chip he had to play.
"I'm a private investigator," Fred began carefully, still going over all the angles in his head. "I'm here on behalf of a client. The nature of the job is confidential, but I can assure you what I'm looking for has nothing to do with you or your business."
Osborne frowned.
"Do you like baseball?"
"Excuse me?"
"Baseball," Osborne said. "That old earth sport."
What was the man getting at?
"I'm familiar with it, but not really a fan."
"So you know how the game works?"
Fred nodded.
"Good," Osborne said, "because that's strike one.
I asked you a question, you didn't answer. If it goes down to McCovey, it involves my business. You crapped all over my house. No one dies on McCovey without my permission.
Fred thought of mentioning the stacks of corpses in Grim Tyrant Valley, but that probably wasn't a good idea.
I'm sorry about that, Mr. Osborne.
Piss on your sorry. Strike one. You do not want to reach strike three.
But those bodies aren't on me, Fred said. They were trying to kill me. I just defended myself.
Osborne held up two fingers.
And there's your second strike. For the last time, Fred, if those bodies aren't on you, who do I put them on?
Osborne was forcing the issue. Fred had to take his shot. One way or another, Fred's next words were the checkmate. If the apparent rift between Osborne and Greedock wasn't what he hoped, then Fred was about to give Osborne all the reason he needed to cut Fred's head off and mail it special delivery to the owner of the Bootleg Arms. It was Fred's turn to lean forward and dead-eye Stedmore Osborne as he said, "Greedock, the Splithead." Osborne thought on that for a long time.
"Those were Greedock's guys out in the dunes?"
Fred nodded.
"You're a liar."
"Of course I am," Fred said. "That's my job, to lie. But this is the truth. Who else has the juice and the balls, metaphorically speaking, of course, to land Quith warriors armed to the teeth on your Purest Nation paradise right under your nose and without asking permission?"
Osborne's next question was inevitable, and it would determine whether divulging Greedock's involvement saved Fred's life or ended it.
"All right, Fred. Why?"
"He and I are both looking for the same thing."
"What does Greedock want? What are you after?"
"I can't tell you that. It's privilege information."
Osborne didn't say a word. He didn't give any visible signal. But in the next moment, Fred's right ear was numb, the space between his temples was burning, and blood began to seep into his vision. He also found, much to his surprise, he was now lying on the floor and couldn't quite remember how he'd come to be there. Then he looked up and saw Sammy standing above him. He was holding a pistol in his hand, the butt of which contained Fred's blood and several strands of his hair. Fred hadn't been aware of Sammy drawing the weapon, nor had he sensed the blow coming. Through the pain and disorientation, Fred was glad he hadn't taken on Frankie and Sammy back at the hotel.
"I want to know what Greedock wants with your client,"
Osborne demanded from somewhere that seemed very far away. Fred tried to get to his hands and knees, but found that task required more coordination than he currently possessed. He let himself sag back down.
"It's my client's business,"
he said with as much finality as he could project while bleeding on someone's floor.
"It isn't yours or that furry butcher's. That's all I can tell you."
Two sets of hands lifted Fred up like he was no more than a toddler, then set him hard back in the chair. Osborne looked at Frankie. He seemed to be asking the man a question without speaking. Frankie stared down at Fred. Again, that thoughtful shrug.
"Sammy could probably get it out of him, but by the time we broke him down enough to spill it, his brain would be jelly. Counterproductive." "Diamond hard?"
Osborne asked Frankie.
"Diamond hard,"
Frankie confirmed. Osborne leaned back in his chair. He reached into a desk drawer and pulled out a white handkerchief, which he tossed to Fred. Fred wondered how many handkerchiefs Osborne had in that drawer. Fred pressed the fabric to his wounded scalp. Osborne scratched his nose. He stared.
"Well, Fred, if I can't have whatever this hot item is, then I guess you're the only currency I got. Greedock seems to want you pretty bad."
"And you can give me to him if helping to make him even more powerful is what you want."
Osborne's eyes grew deadly again.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"I don't know. Why didn't he tap you to begin with? Why didn't we have this conversation the last time I was on McCovey?"
Osborne didn't answer that, but he didn't get angry and have Fred bashed on the other ear either. Instead, he turned his gaze from Fred. There was an image floating on Osborne's desk. It was a woman, beautiful and blonde, and a small child. The child was unmistakably Osborne's progeny. Fred could see it in the eyes. That made the woman his wife, or at least the mother of his child, and since she was in the image, she meant something to him. Osborne took a drink, staring at the image of his family longer than he probably realized. When he spoke again, it was much more reserved than before. The bravado was gone. His anger at Fred and his thirst for any edge had dulled.
That still doesn't give me a reason why I shouldn't seal you in an airtight container and ship your ass to my Shamacath as tribute.
For starters, because of how bitter that word, Shamacath, seems to taste in your mouth. Osborne looked at the image of his family again.
Emotion is the enemy of business, he said, more to himself than to Fred.
Maybe, but it can be part of a strategy.
Yours or mine?
The words gave Fred a new respect for the man's mind. Osborne wasn't going to let Fred play him, but he was listening. Delivering me won't have the upside you think. If you bring me in, Greedock has to wonder what I told you. Maybe things he didn't want you to know. You put yourself on his radar as a possible liability. On the other hand, you're not under any obligation to handle this. He didn't charge you with it. If I close my case, the heat doesn't fall on you, but it does weaken Greedock. It won't cripple him, but anything that hurts him only makes those in competition with him stronger.
So you're saying I got no downside here? Either you take a bite out of the split head, or you die and none of it blows back on me?
Basically. I wish I was in your shoes. Lately, I've had nothing but downside.
And you want to change that?
Fred nodded.
Yes. I need your permission for that, and for one more thing.
Osborne deliberated in silence for less than 60 seconds, but Fred felt every single one tick by. With each moment, he was steeling himself for a last, desperate stand if this didn't go his way. He would go for Sammy first, drive an elbow into his Adam's apple, and get his gun, take Frankie out next. If he dropped them, he'd have to take out Dean before the big man could draw. Fred knew it wouldn't work, but if he was going to die, he would die fighting, not begging.
My permission, Stedmar said. And what's the one more thing?
I need to go after someone who works for Greedock.
Stedmar nodded.
Uh-huh. Who?
Name is Carney. He works in the mines.
Stedmar looked at Frankie.
We know a Carney?
No, Mr. Osborne, Frankie said.
He doesn't work for me. And since my Shamacath didn't tell me about him, I don't know anything about the guy. That means he's not under my protection.
Osborne stood.
I don't care what happens to this Carney, as long as it doesn't point back to me. I'll give you a 24-hour pass, Gonzaga. After that, I want you off McCovey, and you don't ever come back. Not ever. You had a fancy fake identity, and I found you this time, didn't I?
Fred nodded.
And how did you do that?
Osborne smiled.
Wouldn't you like to know? What matters is, I found you this time, I'll find you again.
Well, can I at least ask if anyone else knows I'm here? I mean, did I screw up and all of McCovey knows I'm back in town? Or is this some talent that's specific to your organization?
Then Osborne made a mistake. He turned and looked at Dean. Dumb-looking Dean was the one who'd known Fred had returned. Fred didn't know how, but that was good information to have for the future. Dean shook his head.
No one knows, Mr. Osborne.
Osborne turned back to Fred.
24 hours, Gonzaga. You're not gone. Your costumes won't matter. I'll put you in a hole so deep, they won't turn you up if they strip mine this place for the next 1,000 years.
Fred nodded. Every muscle relaxed, and he found even the pain in his head lessened. Osborne motioned to the door with his glass. The meeting was over. Chapter 20. Raphael. The axe handle tastes briefly of oak and dirt, and something that might be rotten. After the blow, it comes away streaked with blood and carrying two of Rico's teeth, now embedded in the wood. The teeth sparkle wetly, pink-white boats in a sea of scratched wood grain. He tastes his own blood, coppery and viscous, pooling around his tongue, until he vomits what feels like a half pint of the stuff. Fingers as hard and strong as railroad spikes curl into a fist with his hair caught vice-like between them. They pry his head back. The light from the bonfire bathes his blood-streaked face.
You watch this, Rico!
The voice belongs to Sarnoff, Rico's lieutenant. Sarnoff's other hand is holding the slightly curved end of the axe handle that just broke Rico's jaw. Dennison is sitting on Rico's outstretched legs, while Zhang and Fletcher hold his arms. Rico can't even struggle against them. The rest of the guys from his squad stand in the background, many hoping the darkness beyond the firelight will hide the guilt and pain and doubt written all over their battle-hardened faces.
"You ain't come back here in a long, long time, Cher," the Loa says.
It sits gingerly on the thick end of Sarnoff's axe handle, lounging in Rico's blood. In the distance, the bishop strikes Raphael in much the same way Sarnoff just bashed Rico. The bishop, however, is wielding his ornate staff crowned with a steel infinity symbol. And while Rico is at the edge of a forest of blue-green trees, each engulfed with pale orange creepers, Raphael is in a clearing. A clearing surrounded by a cheering crowd of hundreds. Raphael is standing on a pile of wood. He is tied to a stake that sticks up from that pile like the mast of a ship without sails. Raph is terrified. It's all over his face. He was a crappy poker player. He couldn't hide his emotions. His expressive face was one of the first things that Rico noticed. The staff strikes home again. The infinity symbol cuts Raph's forehead, opening up a geyser of red above his right eye. Absurdly, insanely, Rico hopes they haven't damaged Raph's hands. Raph's emotions run deep. Things that most people don't notice affect him in a spiritual way. You wouldn't think a kind soul like that belonged in a fighter's body, but Raph has crazy coordination and fast hands. He was the division champ at his weight. A real prospect to go pro in the octagon. But Rico knows that will never happen. Raph will never fight again. Raph will never make it off of that pile of dry wood.
"Look at him," Sarnoff says. "You'd be down there with him if you weren't one of us, boy. You don't cure this disease of yours, and next time it will be you down there. We saved you, but this happens again, and we'll watch you burn."
"He don't know, does he?"
the Loa asks. It reaches out and pulls one of Fred's teeth from the axe handle, examining it like a curio from ancient Victorian times.
"He don't know the only thing you want in all the world, across all them stars, is to be down there and burn right alongside Raphael. You don't want to be saved, do you, Cher?"
Rico didn't. He watches as women wearing blue robes light torches. They walk around the pile of wood, sticking the torches in among the tinder, waiting only long enough to see the orange flames spring to life before moving on to the next spot. Rico knows Raph is going to die. Rico wants to die with him.
"But you didn't die," the Loa reminds him. "I think after all this time, you'd learn to be glad for that, at least."
Glowing patches spread and expand until they join, until the entire pile crackles with the low one's touch, and at the center of it all, Raphael, the firelight reflecting off the blood that sheets his face.
"Why you want to see this now, boy?"
The Loa sounds more frustrated than anything.
"This is the one where it all started."
The flames reach Raph. Fred watches his face contort in a scream, but the sound is drowned out by the righteous cheers of the onlookers. Rico begins to struggle anew. It's futile, even pathetic. But it doesn't stop Sarnoff from jabbing him brutally with the end of the axe handle to still him.
"Ain't nothing good about to come from this here, boy. I thought we was past this."
A part of Rico will never really leave this moment. If he should live to be an old man and die in his bed surrounded by 50 children and grandchildren a million light years from where this happened, the real Federico Esteban Giuseppe Gonzaga, the man that Rico was born to be before this hated religion took everything away, that Rico will still be trapped in this moment. The moment when his real self died alongside the love of his life. The accelerant they doused Raph's body with turns him into a human fireball. His perfect olive skin blisters bright red, then turns black. His scream becomes a silent, grotesque mask burned into his face. Something breaks, or burns, or cracks, and Raph's hand, his right hand, comes free. Skin replaced by flickering flame, the hand reaches out, clutching, grasping. The hand reaches toward Rico. In that moment, Rico knows it's a reactive thing. Raphael doesn't know he's there, but in Rico's heart, a different truth hits hard and lodges forever. The truth that Raph is reaching out to him, reaching out and thinking, why didn't you save me? You said you loved me, that we would always protect each other. Why did you let them kill me? For the first time in years, Fred woke up screaming. He was dripping with sweat. His sheets were soaked clean through. In a moment of sheer, disoriented panic, he snatched up the entropic pistol from his nightstand and brought it to bear on every dark corner and crevice of his bedroom. He aimed it everywhere, over and over again, making sure that the holy men, the Loa, Sarnoff, even the flaming Raph hadn't come back with him to invade this lonely reality. The mania subsided, faded away like a splash of water soaking into dry silicon. Fred climbed out of bed. He wandered through his apartment in a half daze, holding the pistol loosely at his side. Eventually, he came to stand at his living room window. It was night, but the street below was still choked with activity. It was good to think a lot of those sentients couldn't sleep either. In an absurd way, it made Fred feel more normal. It made the nightmare, uncontrollable and inescapable as it was, seem to matter a little less. Still, he never went back to sleep that night. He didn't even try.
You have been listening to The Detective, a Galactic Football League novella. The Detective is also available as an ebook and as a full-length audiobook. If you want the whole story with no waiting, visit scottsigler.com/thedetective for links to Amazon, Audible, and more. Follow Scott on Instagram and Twitter, where he is at Scott Sigler, one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/scottsigler. The Detective audiobook was directed by A.B. Kovacs and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Copyright 2019, Empty Set Entertainment, all rights reserved. Theme music is from the band Amps and Volts.